Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is the Music Buzz Podcast. The Music Buzz Podcast features candid discussions with and about those behind the scenes in the music business, including industry veterans representing the segments of musician, design, and live. All three Music Buzz podcast hosts have spent their careers working with the biggest names in entertainment and have been and are still a fly on the wall. Dayton Clark as the drummer for John Mellencamp's band for over 20 years and various solo projects. Hugh Syme, a world-renowned graphic artist for the biggest names in music and the corporate world. Andy Wilson, an award-winning marketing and public relations executive with over 20 years of combined multi-level entertainment industry experience in the music and sports business. Now let's buzz.
Hello and welcome back to the Music Buzz Podcast. I'm one of your co-hosts, Andy Wilson, along with Dane Clark and also Hugh Syme. Today's guest on the Music Buzz Podcast has over three decades of experience. It's AJ Croce. He's established himself a reputation as a piano player and serious vocal stylist who pulls from a host of musical traditions and anti-heroes. Part New Orleans, part juke joint, part soul, he handles lead, vocals, and a rollicking piano with irresistible, loose, and easy style. Be sure to check out his 2021 album, By Request, and also 2017's Just Like Medicine. We'll talk about both. And also recent tune, So Much Fun, for a taste of his amazing songs. Furthermore, AJ is also the son of the late, great Jim Croce, which we'll dive into that as well. But welcome to the Music Buzz Podcast, AJ Croce.
Hey, thank you so much.
Yeah, man, it's really an honor to talk to you today, AJ. Your latest single, So Much Fun, is So Much Fun. But let's come back to that in a moment. I wanted to start by talking about your 2017 record, Just Like Medicine, produced by the legendary Dan Penn, I might add. And I believe I read that you had wanted to make a quote-unquote real soul album, not a throwback 60s thing. And man, did you ever succeed. This is a great record. Just starting at the top, Got to Get Out of My Head. That could be a great Lost Leon Russell song or something, man. I love those dark kind of voodoo-y verses and the poppier chorus you go into, the juxtaposition of that. Great production. Really great. The second tune, The Heart That Makes You, what is the full title of the second song?
The Heart That Makes Me Whole is something I wrote with Leon.
The first thing I thought was Mad Dogs and the Englishman. What a great song, man.
Thank you, man. Yeah, Leon and I wrote a bunch together. I'd opened up for him in the 90s at festivals and you know, venues and whatnot. But I always came on before him. I didn't know if he ever saw me play. And then about 20 years ago now, I went to see him and Willie Nelson do this duo show, which was the best show I ever saw either of them do. And I had played with Willie. I'd played keys and, you know, stuff with him on stage before. And so I went back and said hello. And it was just the three of us on Willie's bus, which was rare because usually there's so many folks around. In this case, we just started talking about music, and Leon and I really connected, not on so much, you know, his stuff, which I love, but it wasn't my influence. His influences were my influences, similar to my father in a way. You know, Ray Charles was my gateway drug, you know, and it was, but we went back from there.
I hear Alan Toussaint and Dr. John big time in your playing.
Yeah, Dr. John, for some reason, you know, his bass player, David Berard, who played with him for 40 years, has been with me for about 7 years now out of New Orleans. But curiously, I never listened to Dr. John. I listened to a lot of Alan Toussaint. I listened to, you know, all the Lee Dorsey and Irma Thomas stuff he did. And of course, the Meters stuff. But I listened to Professor Longhair and Fats Domino. Again, the older generation, James Booker. Somehow missed Dr. John. You know, I mean, of course, I fell in love with it. Once my first album came out, someone said, oh, it reminds me of Dr. John. I'm like, I got to hear him. I knew right place, wrong time and that stuff. But I didn't know how great he was, you know. And I think Toussaint and Art Neville were playing on those big cuts anyway. So it's curious. Anyway, Leon and I connected on all these old piano players, Little Brother Montgomery, and going back further to Fats Waller, James P. Johnson, Willie the Lion, then the boogie guys like Albert Ammons and Meat Lux Lewis and Pete Johnson, and then Johnny Johnson and Little Richard, and Fats Domino, all these players we had this love for, Ellington and Basie and all that. And so, and Thelonious Monk, of course, but Ray Charles was the first connection, and we both had that. And I got a call a few months later and he asked if I wanted to write. And we just started writing, from a distance, even when we lived in the same city here in Nashville.
Well, when I listened to you and watched you this morning on Nothing From Nothing, I confess to having always thought that you were a chip off the obvious block, which would be your dad, and that you were more of a folk musician. And was I ever blown away your chops on piano? I mean, despite the fact that Alan and Mac Rebenek and all those people are in your circle of people, you are remarkable. Your technique is amazing. Did you study?
I lost my sight when I was 4. So I grew up listening to records, my dad's records. I would put all the good stuff over on the left side when I came across it. And he had tons of great records. And you really can hear it, the R&B influence in a lot of his recordings. Don't Mess Around With Jim is a lot like it's like a Lieber and Stoller song, but it's also like Jimmy Reed.
When I listen to your body of work and your performances, I mean, you're quite the chameleon. I mean, you really adapt to songs and you make songs. I mean, Sail on Sailor, give me a break. That version is beautiful.
Thank you.
Unexpected, but brilliant, a brilliant version. I'm a big Beach Boy fan, so I was all set to be bathed in vocals. And there you are. Digressing from that norm.
And the way that you started that track out was very unexpected, because I was just listening through and I wasn't even sure what it was for a second. And that's my favorite, you know, that's the last great Brian Wilson song. So I know the song well, but then I got it about 3 lines in. I said, wait a second. So yeah, touche, man.
Well, thank you so much, you guys. But I imagine that being like, I was trying to think if Chess Records had a psychedelic period, what it would sound like. And that's how I produced it, you know, and arranged it. And so, you know, we've got, like, I'm playing harmonium on an overdub while there's a bass harmonica playing, and it's just, they're kind of stereo on either side. It was fun to do. And some of the songs on that album I played, you know, very similar to the original, because it was all about these requests, you know, from friends.
That's how the whole album started. It was friends requesting.
I love entertaining. I would have friends come over and they would, you know, undoubtedly at one point or another, they'd say, hey, do you know this song? Some, a lot of musicians, some not, but they would go, like with the Randy Newman song that's on that album. A friend of mine came over and said, hey, do you know this Flaming Groovies tune? And I said, well, that's Randy Newman. But so I tried to, in that case, pay a little tribute to the Flaming Groovies, a tip of the hat to Randy Newman, but also imagine what it would have been like if Little Richard played with the Flaming Groovies. And that's how it was approached, you know?
You're the only guy, other guy other than myself, that's ever mentioned the band Flamin' Groovies. That's a great record, the Teenage Head record. That's always been one of my favorites. Yeah.
The arrangements, I mean, you obviously surround yourself with some of the best. I mean, when you visualize a song and you work it up yourself, are you kind of OCD, very hands-on in terms of arrangement, or do you let all the...
Oh, yeah.
You pre-draft how you want it to sound?
I do. I always stay open to deviations from it, because that's where magic happens. As you guys know, it's the unexpected, it's the mistake that becomes precious, you know, not the preciousness, you know. I think I really started thinking about arrangement when I was about 13, and really just fell in love with Toussaint stuff long before I worked with him or played with him or any of that stuff. It was one of those things where I heard this Irma Thomas song and I needed to know who was playing piano, who arranged it, who, you know, produced this. How does music sound this amazing? And it all came back to Alan Toussaint. And so he was a same thing, you know, with Ray Charles, listening to those arrangements growing up. They were, you know, they were big band arrangements, but there was something gospel, there was something soulful about it. It was, you know, sophisticated, but there was a sort of melodic dissonance in it that I just embraced.
You found your way to all of those. I mean, there's a lot of sophistication to your music and your chord structures and so on. Apart from being an avid listener to and arrangements, did you study piano? Did you get your chops through rudiments, or did you just...
Like I said, I couldn't see well enough to read, but I could write my own charts and make them big enough. And I studied obviously my scales. I studied jazz, you know, with different musicians. Daniel Jackson was someone I studied with. He was living in San Diego, where I lived at the time. He had played with all kinds of folks. Jimmy Smith, great saxophone player and composer, and really composed in a very Ellingtonian style, with the ear to, you know, hard bop as well. But it was this kind of thing that I want. He had, you know, been Ray Charles' band leader for a period of time in the 60s. And so I grew from that stuff. Different players, sax players, guitar players taught me, drummers taught me. Everyone that you play with teaches you. And then, you know, I grew up listening. So the Fats Waller stuff was hard. My hands aren't as big as Fats Waller's, so I couldn't reach those 13ths, like just like bam, you know. But by listening to Mississippi John Hurt, which allowed me to, I can cover that with one hand. I figured out how stride worked. Little Brother Montgomery, very simplified version of stride. It's more blues, but I got the idea. And it was through different people that I learned how to do that more complicated stuff.
Your ear towards production and just how things should sound. You have certainly surrounded yourself with some notables. I'm looking at the laundry list.
In the short time we worked together, Mitchell taught me something that I had never known in all the records, and a totally different perspective. Usually I think of taking these vintage instruments that I love, miking them well, and recording them. His idea is that beautiful old instruments have an innate sound that is going to be there no matter what. Let's make it sound like it's never sounded before. And it was a completely different approach, and I loved it. And it really turned my ear, you know, that was probably 5 or 6 years ago, maybe more, to a different way of thinking about recording acoustic instruments.
Which you have a plethora of on your wall back there that I can see. Some beautiful vintage guitars, it looks like there.
Yeah, there's guitars all over.
Where to write on, piano, or where do you tend to start?
Both. You know, I know so many more of my options with piano than I do with guitar, but that's also a good thing as a songwriter, because with guitar, I have a lot more limitations. You know, I picked it up in my 30s. So it was, it's I love the instrument, but I don't own it yet. With the piano, I feel like I own it and I know a lot of my options. And I learn something new every day. But that being said, going to guitar, simplifying things is a really good thing.
I find with other piano players I talk to, myself included, though, my chops might approach Eltonian kind of range, but nothing like Alan or Mac and those guys. But when you write on piano, do you find that you get into not so much the habit, but the tendency is to write a piano song when you're writing on piano? Do you think outside that box while you're writing on piano, so you're already anticipating that you won't necessarily use the piano in the song, or does that piano drive the song as you write it?
It depends on the groove. It depends on the changes. It depends on the lyrics. I just got this amazing new instrument. It's really a Fender Rhodes, but it is made by a company called Vintage Vibe, and they were like the repair guys for Rhodes and Whirlies and Clabs for 25 years, and had the factory full of like new old stock parts. And then this stuff ran out, and they started manufacturing one piece at a time. Eventually, they had enough stuff to make their own instrument, and it's wonderful. And so there's been some stuff that I've written at the piano lately. And then I go into the other room and I play it there and I'm like, that's where I hear it. There's other things, you know, you play melodies and you think about it being a different instrument all the time. I'm as someone that's an avid listener to other music, all different kinds of world music and just everything that I can, I find that with a melody, I often second guess myself. I go, well, I heard that here and I heard that here. And there's not a song I listen to by someone else where I don't recognize some of the roots of it, even if it's not intentional. But I sort of catch myself all the time and go, how do I make that a little different? Or how do I alter that or make it unique, you know?
Well, like I said in the earlier part of this conversation, you are like a chameleon, both arrangementally and vocally. You go from the tender to the
screaming. Yeah. As soon as I scream, it gets a bit raspy, and it's just the nature of my voice, you know.
To Hugh's point about being a chameleon, and that definitely stuck out to me as well. And I know you've done about 10 albums now, and it's a mix, you know, blues, soul, pop, jazz, rock, you name it. So when you're going into a new record, are you thinking like, hey, I want to make a jazz record. Oh, I want to make a rock record. And that's kind of where you jump off from? Or does that just kind of come organically?
It depends on the songs. I think it's the collection of songs really speak to it. Like in the case of what I have right now, because there's so much from the lockdown period through now that I haven't recorded, even before then, that I, you know, I already had by request done when lockdown happened. So it was just released a year later. So I have all this original stuff, which stuff fits together and is really sort of a concise concept. What's the best idea for this? The other factor is the label, you know, just depending on what they might be looking for as far as what they think might be good for a project. You know, the label suggested doing a cover album, which I'd never done that. I hadn't thought of it. I said, well, let's see what we can come up with. And it was really about the theme of entertaining and with different friends and memorable evenings.
So if Metal Blade comes calling, you're going to be ready to make a metal record, right?
I'm not against it.
Well, I tell you, I really got suckered in by two beautiful kind of jazz torch songs on Just Like Medicine. We almost sound like a male Billie Holiday or something.
But she was such an influence.
Move On and I Couldn't Stop, man. Those are really great.
Thank you. John Simon arranged Move On. We had worked together on my first album and have remained friends. And
he did the first band record, right?
First two band records. First two Taj Mahal records. The Janis Joplin records. And Mrs. Robinson, and a ton of just all different kinds of music. But he is just a wonderful arranger and such a talented person. And I knew that he would hear how to create a really interesting arrangement for it.
You were talking about Alan Toussaint, his arranging, and his horn arranging reminds me of the Rock of Ages record that he did all the horns for the band. I don't know if that was a big one for you, but that's a classic for me.
You know, the first two are the big ones for me. You know, there's individual songs on other albums I love, but like those first two, Big Pink and the Band, I just always loved that. And I thought that genre-wise, they really straddled a lot of stuff. They weren't easy to categorize. And that's something, you know, that's I've always wanted in my music, but also that I recognize has probably held me back in a lot of ways too, because had I continued on in the first couple records as being sort of jazz R&B-ish artist, I could have probably done pretty well, you know, just sticking to that. But I get bored playing one genre of things. I like having all different colors in the palette, you know.
Well, we're glad you do. Follow your muse, man, because...
How well put, considering we use the term chameleon. It's true about you, though. I mean, you have that capacity to shapeshift.
I just think it is following the muse, and it is doing what feels right for the song, you know? And that's really the bottom line is what... And on a different day, it might have been completely different, you know? I think that's one of the beauties of playing live is that, which I grew up doing since I was a kid, since I was in my early teens. And I just feel like, you know, it wasn't the money. It was the chance to be able to take an idea that you had already sort of thought you had really a clear picture on a concept arrangement wise, lyrically or rhythmically, and just kind of alter it. Some things, most songs take about 6 months. I try and throw new ones into the set and work on them, let them just sit there, see if they're how the audience reacts. And then by the time I know if it's really solid, then I feel like the band has it or I have it in my head. What's working and what's not.
Do you ever do that before? Do you take songs out before you record them to kind of work out how they're going to work out in the studio?
Always.
I've seen the album recorded too prematurely. And then when you hear it a year later, the live performance is often so much better and more fleshed out, you know?
You've all seen that. It's curious because there are exceptions to that rule. There's, you know, going in like Ray Charles and Betty Carter, I worked with an engineer named Al Schmidt, who I'm sure you guys have known over the years. And he was the engineer on a lot of these Ray Charles records. And he said it was done in 6 hours, showed me how it was mic'd and how it was done. But it was done in 6 hours and was possible because there was a really clear picture of what the arrangement was. And so there are ways to make an instantaneous decision or a thoughtful decision beforehand.
The organization has to be there.
I know your relationship to your dad's songs changed when about 15 years ago or so, and obviously led up to the Croce Plays Croce thing that you're doing now. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, that time period and also what's brought you up to doing what you're doing now with that?
You know, I've probably been asked, you know, 1,000 times if I would be into playing or recording his music. And when I was looking for a record deal, there was some really amazing financial opportunities, but I just didn't feel like there was any integrity in it. And I love his songs. But I was a piano player. And I didn't feel like I was going to be able to do them any justice. So from just a cover band perspective of it, I wasn't going to be able to add something that wasn't better already, in my opinion. And then as time went on, you know, there were times I regretted it because I went my own way and that can be really expensive. And, you know, not everyone digs that. So, but nevertheless, in my early 30s, I was, you know, I've been working behind the scenes for years with my father's catalog and really preserving the legacy of it as a publisher. So when I was in my early 30s, I was transferring some of these tapes over to digital, and I heard this recording of his, because, you know, he had an 18-month career, really. Before then, he played covers. He would throw one of his own songs into the set. But there was this one collection of songs on a woolen sack tape, and they were the exact songs that I had played since I was 12. Old Western swing stuff, like Hank Thompson, and there was Bessie Smith, and there was a Fats Waller, and there was a Jimmy Rogers song, and there was a Pink Anderson song, and a Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee, and there was all of these songs I had played, and they were the deep cuts, the oddball songs. Like, how did I choose these exact songs to perform? And it gave me chills. And I said, I realized that I had more in common with him from where his influences came from and his taste in music than I had ever imagined. Even though I, you know, grown up listening to his records, it was still choosing those songs. There was, you know, 1,000 records. How do you pick those exact oddball deep cuts from, you know, obscure musicians? And I realized we had this connection. So a few years after that, it was, would have been his 70th birthday. And I decided to do a little tribute to him and incorporate some of the influences, some of the songs that you could tell influenced his stuff. So some Liebermann Stoller, some Jimmy Reed, some Sam Cooke. And I realized that this combination of music was really very natural, but I felt like I needed to put a bit more of myself in there. And that's really how the whole concept started about 5 years ago, was to play his music, to play my music, and to play the music that really connects us. And it's all about that connection. And so it's interesting in that what I thought was just about his legacy became about two generations of this similar legacy. And it's fascinating. What I thought would have been, when I started playing some of his music, especially on guitar, and then would move to the piano, I saw that the audience all of a sudden understood something that I didn't think they would. I didn't think they would see something uniquely different. And I didn't think they would see where the similarities, where we connected and where, you know, where we went in different directions. And so it was rewarding in a way that I didn't expect. And it also gave me a way to continue on this sort of legacy of writing and embracing all kinds of music and sharing it with an audience.
I think that as a kid listening to your father's archive of music, a lot more of that rubs off than we realize. There's a lot of osmosis in play, apart from the possible genetic.
You know, Leroy Brown was, you know, obviously that was a piano-led song, but it always bothered me that the piano felt too stiff. It didn't feel right to me, you know, because that was something I did. I understood that. So when I play it live, it's just a hair more laid back. It's a little more in the pocket than this kind of rigid, vanilla version of Boogie Woogie. And so there's little things that I do to make his stuff mine. And a song like Car Wash Blues, I play it like it's a New Orleans song, you know, because it has a lot of those R&B influences that you hear, you know. My dad loved Alan Toussaint. And my parents sang, you know, his stuff when they were in the 60s, you know, and when they were performing together. So that stuff was in there. And there's no doubt that I heard it and was influenced by it.
You made a poignant comment about the one song that your dad wrote for you, Time in a Bottle. I just caught a piece of an interview this morning, and you said something that was pretty obvious but pretty profound, and that is a lot of surviving family members have photos. They have pictures, you know, static, still images, and you have his music. You have so much, such a greater wealth. I wouldn't call it nostalgia, just memories, you know.
It's an added dimension. It's a third dimension.
You made another comment, which I loved, to this interviewer. He said, if it's not the cure, it's a really good remedy. That's a great observation. That, you know, you obviously you can't, as you said, we grieve forever, but that comment was pretty profound. I loved it.
Well, and it was off the cuff, so I'm not sure where it was from, but to me, that's the way music is, you know, it's magic.
It's also a great lyric, which I'm going to steal.
Okay, go for it. It's all yours.
AJ, tell us about the name of the game.
Name of the game was a demo. It was a demo that was recorded in a Holiday Inn in 1973. It was after my father had already finished I Got a Name. And that was the second album he recorded that year. First one was Life and Times. Second one was I Got a Name. And so he was, you know, he was on a writing streak. He was, you know, on fire at the moment right then. I have all these, you know, cassette tapes and reel to reels of him writing new stuff. And in the case of that, it was something that was not completed, but I just thought it was really close. And I figured there would be a cool way to produce it. I wanted there to be the acoustic guitar element that would have been there, but I was also thinking about the time period and what the, you know, rock and roll influences would have been in the following year, and in wanting to do something new. And I thought about, honestly, I thought about T-Rex, I thought about Elton John, I thought about all of these kind of early 70s glam artists and the Faces. And I thought about how the instrumentation on it could blend together and still feel like it was a Jim Croce song. And so, you know, finished it the way it turned out, you know.
I love the Wurlitzer in the acoustic guitar, and that's Vince Gill on guitar, right?
It is, yeah.
He's no slouch.
No. Vince Gill, Colin Linden's also playing on it. Colin Linden takes the first solo or the first half of the solo, and then Vince Gill takes the second half. And Colin's playing the guitar that it was written on, you know? So that was cool. It's an old 30s Gibson L00.
You have an amazing arsenal of producers and co-musicians. Quite the laundry list. I notice a lot of your covers, album covers, if I might just segue quickly into the art world. A lot of your covers are personality covers, a lot of images of you, which is great. It's what works in that genre. And then suddenly out of nowhere, So Much Fun has this great kind of almost Victorian image on it. Was that a conscious sort of shift into something more conceptual?
No, you know, I think the conceptual, I really didn't want to be on another album cover after Cantos, which was around 2005, I think, 2006. And so the one after that, Cage of Muses, was like a, you know, it was like a book cover, the no photos of me. And then the next one was a real concept that my late wife created for 12 Tales. And that was more conceptual in that there was elements of kind of a nouveau, you know, Art Nouveau style, but also it was kind of hippie nouveau, you know? and collage-like, even though a lot of it was painted or pen and ink. And then after that, you know, I think the next one was just like medicine. Dan Penn really thought, he's like, you have to have your face on it. All those old albums have, you know, your face on them. And so I thought of that being like, you know, like one of those kind of 60s soul albums, and the font and everything was done accordingly, you know, with the arrows and the, that kind of stuff. But yeah, no, I believe me, that particular single, I wasn't in town. I needed ideas. I had an idea about it being like Mardi Gras influenced. And I looked at a bunch of old Mardi Gras posters from the 30s and 40s and 50s up through the 70s and thought about what would be kind of cool. And that's how it turned out.
Speaking of album covers, I mean, this is the 50th anniversary, right, of You Don't Mess Around With Jim.
Yeah, it's pretty iconic.
That strange window thing or whatever it is.
It's an outhouse.
Okay.
It's an outhouse in the house that my childhood home, and turned into, I think it was like it was like a pigsty, you know. It's not very big, very small inside. It's an arched window. It's in an old farmhouse in Lindell, Pennsylvania, where I lived for first couple years of my life.
It's so strange that it's so small, because when you see the original album cover, it feels like it's something that would be on like some castle or something.
Exactly. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Yeah.
And yet an outhouse.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, but it's, you know, it's kind of on the main line in Pennsylvania, which was at one point kind of a, I don't know if it is anymore, but it used to be a kind of foo-foo area where folks could live outside the city. It was kind of the first suburb in America, I think, back in the 1800s, and people could take a train into the city but live in the country. And so there was a lot of that Pennsylvania Dutch design out there.
Did that wall go through a considerable amount of decay? Because the original cover seemed to have more of a plaster field around it. And in that interview where you were walking on your property, there seemed a very small relic left of that, just...
That part looks pretty much the same and has ever since I can remember. Like, if I'm back there visiting family in Philly or something, then I may stop out there. It just depends. But it's in disrepair. The folks that own the property are trying to raise money to fix it, which I'm all for. But I think are trying to raise is just exorbitant, like $65,000 to fix an outhouse. And I just couldn't believe that. I guess I would love to help make it happen, but also I don't know how you make an outhouse cost that much.
No kidding.
I think we could get it done for about $1,000 and some hard work.
Get the right contractor on it. Come on, a couple grand, surely.
Yeah. Do it yourself.
But you're doing some shows in celebration of the 50th anniversary too, yeah.
I finished the last one about a week and a half ago for this year. Next year is going to be a slightly altered version of it, just because next year's the 50th anniversary of the next two albums. So instead of playing the whole album as I did with this year's 50th concerts, it's all multimedia. And as I played... every show was uniquely different. I play live. I haven't used in ears. We're not playing to a click track, and I need to have it timed in my head of what's going on behind me. So I learned along the way how to make it feel really smooth and work with all of the multimedia, because we're actually playing. As you guys know, there's a lot of people out there that do the multimedia stuff. Probably 75-80% of them aren't playing or are playing to a track. And this is all live and real. So there was a learning curve with it. And part of that, I figured for the next year of 50th anniversary shows, which I'll be doing, I'm sure I'll play one in Indiana, because you guys are too far away. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think the next, those are going to start up again next summer and through the fall. And it'll be the all three albums celebrated, multimedia, but the same idea as a Croce Plays Croce. There'll be all the big hits, a few of my favorite deep cuts, a few of my things, some of where the influences came from, and it'll all be tied together. I think it's going to be even more fun than these. You know, it really was emotional for me, but it was even, I think, more emotional for audiences. Those songs had never been performed with a band. My dad played as a duo with Mari Muehleisen. And if anyone saw him perform, it was just like that. Every once in a while, there was a piano player that would come in after Leroy Brown, but he never played with a band. So hearing these songs for people performed, you know, I think by me, but with all of the images and multimedia stuff, it's very emotional for fans of all different generations, you know.
How many people on stage in your lineup for this show?
This show is 7 on stage, 2 background singers. David Berard also sings background and plays bass. Gary Malibur is on drums. Gary and I've played together. He and David joined around the same time about 7 years ago. And then on guitar, electric, acoustic, and violin is James Pennebaker. And then Phil Hewley is playing electric and acoustic as a, you know, second fill-in guitar player. And I go between guitar and piano, as well as, you know, I'll have my Rhodes there.
The new Rhodes.
Yeah. Whenever I can. It's wonderful. It's so cool. And I always loved that Billy Preston Silver Sparkle Fender Rhodes. And I was looking for one, and it cost almost twice as much now, and it's in disrepair. But if you get one of those Sparkle Top Rhodes, they cost like 10, 12 grand. And it's like nearly twice the price of a new vintage Vibe. That's perfect. And unique thing about the vintage Vibe on the tone.
And in tune, I would assume.
Oh, in tune. The action is absolutely wonderful. Very much.
The action is not as much of a battle as the original Rhodes. Is that right? More balanced?
I love the original Rhodes, but, you know, I'm a little bit young to have ever really dug into one of those when they were pristine and new. So I can only go by the ones in great studios where they've been maintained and go, okay, well, I guess this is what, but everyone I've ever played, doesn't matter which studio, or which venue, everyone is different. This is so wonderful because all the keys are just, are even, all the actions, even the regulations, even, it's great. Plus it has 220, so I can go to Europe and just plug it in.
Speaking of high maintenance instruments,
I love Mellotrons, love them. And, you know, I've never owned one. And I've thought about getting one of those new, you know, synth model ones. Cause I did some sessions, was for EMI, it was for a Dutch artist, and they needed some alternative kind of sounds. And I suggested that I wasn't producing, I was just playing keys on it. And I think, At the time I had sort of a standalone a plug-in, this kind of a virtual instrument for a Mellotron, and it was really good. The thing about the real ones, again, you know, they're not in great shape. And then when you do find one in good shape, they don't have all of the different tapes. They might have the horns or the flutes or the violin, but they won't have the vocals. There's so many cool ones, you know.
Mike Pinder from the Moody Blues did a really decent sample. He recorded both the 10-second tape that stops before the capstan releases the tape, and it's not in tune, which they never were, because he does that version, but he also does a tuned version where the tape is a loop and it continues. So you can go beyond the 10 seconds. It's a pretty decent, and he includes everything from boys choir to even those those like foxtrot samples. Have you heard those?
Oh, yeah. I love it. A couple years back, maybe it's 3.5 years ago, maybe more. 5 years ago, I went and got to play one of the Mighty Wurlitzers. One of the, like, it's up near Seattle. It's a private home had been built around this Wurlitzer and maintained and repaired. And it was like, it was the synthesizer of its day, you know, and being able to play this thing and have all of those kind of sound effects. And, you know, you could have the clopping horse, you know, horse hoofs and the old car horns and all of the oddball special effects you would hear in a silent movie was so much fun. Kind of a similar experience for me as playing a mellotron or really anything like that, a pianette. Pianettes are pretty wild and temperamental as well. But I prefer the analog instruments. I'm not really a synth player. I love organ, but I wouldn't consider myself an organ player.
So are you going to incorporate that Wurlitzer in an album of yours if you haven't already? Are you going to?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it's the what's interesting on that, and I don't mean to bore the audience with stuff, but like when the tone is turned all the way down, it sounds remarkably like a Wurlitzer. And when the tone is turned up, you have, it sounds like the richest, most beautiful road. So it has this thing that makes it very versatile. Yeah. As far as that goes, I mean, I'll bring it with me as much as I can. I generally try and travel as light as I can, saying that with, you know, 10 of us going out, you know,
I'm referring to the big boy that you were talking about.
Oh yeah. That Wurlitzer, man. No, you'd have to come to me for that or come to them. Yeah, the Mighty Wurlitzer. That was amazing. Just being able to play one of those giant pipe organs like that.
So tell us, it's so much fun. Is that the lead off single for something that's a full project that may be out next year?
You know, it could be. It's hard to say. Certainly in keeping with some of the other stuff I've written, although I have a handful of guitar songs that could potentially fit in that world too. I think it really just depends. I'll know in the next couple months. And I plan on going in late April, early May to record an album. So, you know, the producer I'm working with, I'd really like to have someone else. I've produced enough of my own stuff for a while. I think that it would be good to have another set of ears there. And so, yeah, we'll see. We'll see what sounds like fun.
It's really a pleasure talking to you and rediscovering and discovering for the first time a lot of what you do.
It's a real joy, and it's not always been easy. You know, I think people think that because of my father, that it was easy. I think there were some doors that opened, but if you don't have the ability or if you don't have the same vision that the person behind that door has, then it doesn't really help much. And this business, as you all know, is like a roller coaster ride. You know, you think I've made the mistake of having things go, you know, wonderfully, and you buy a new car and, you know, or you fix the house up or you do something and you're like, the next year, everything changes and you're like, oh my God, what did I do? You know,
what do you mean? I can't relate. I mean, after COVID, it's like, what do you mean?
I will never make that mistake again. You know, live and learn.
I'm just going to go back and listen to your earlier records now.
Well, Me and the Bar kind of, I think Me and the Bar held up pretty well. That's something I did with Keltner producing and Bry Cooter plays a lot on that album. There's some great, and Waddy Wachtel, that's a really, David Hidalgo came in and played. That's a really fun, interesting album. It was the hardest album I ever made. It was really difficult.
Some really terrible guys on that record. I mean, you could have got some better guys for it. For sure.
I know. It was funny. Keltner, I think, on purpose had a couple of slide parts recorded on songs that weren't quite right, or that he knew that Rye Cooter wouldn't dig, and he brought them to him, and he's like, "Hey, Rye, what do you think?" And at the time, Rye hadn't played in like a month, you know, hadn't picked up a guitar in a month, and he's like, "I'm coming in tomorrow. I'm going to fix this." I think it was on purpose because they're great friends. And he knew that if he heard something and it wasn't up to his expectations, that he would come in and fix it. But yeah, that one's good. There's stuff on the Adrian James Croce album I'm proud of. And that was a more, you know, 60s influenced pop record in the way of like Nielsen or the Beatles or that kind of, the Kinks were a big influence at that time. All kind of stuff.
So what are you going to play us out with?
Thanks a lot for your time.
Fabulous. Come on. Yeah, man.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.